From 9to5 Mac, this is Stacktrace. As always, I am Guy Rambo, joined by my good friend John Sandel. How are you doing, John?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, Rambo?
I'm doing great as well. Let's start with our usual segments. What have you been working on these days?
So I'm fully at work now on two projects. The first one is the upcoming open source app that we've been talking about a little bit on the show before, which is an app that I've been building, which will be fully open sourced and also hopefully available on the App Store as well. So I'm working on that. And I'm also working on another possible open source project. I really haven't decided yet, but it's my static site generator that I'm working on, because just like with game development, I have to write my own game engine first before I can build a game. It's the same thing here, where there are so many great static site generators out there, but I just find it so, you know, appealing and fun. And, you know, I get so curious that I want to write something of my own to kind of fit my specific use case, and also just to learn how something like static site generation works, because, you know, that's really valuable for me, both in terms of, you know, being able to write about it and stuff like that, but also just to satisfy my kind of inner curiosity. So I've been working on my kind of publishing tool for static sites. And one thing I've done with it, which I think is pretty interesting, is the way I kind of let you define the content that the site is going to display. And the way you can do that is that you can use this special like little syntax. So not only am I writing a static site generator, I'm also writing kind of a mini compiler for like a domain specific language, where you can specify like, I want to take all the articles, pick the top three ones, then run them through this template, then run this script on them. And you can kind of chain these actions together. So I think I might open source this in one form or another, just to, you know, let people kind of have a look at it and see what they think. But regardless, I'll definitely share more like kind of under the hood details, you know, as I kind of get closer and as I figure things out. So that's been a lot of fun to work on.
Yeah, I'm anxious to actually use it myself, because if it's good, I'm probably going to change my site to it.
Right. Yeah, it's going to be awesome. So, I mean, it's going to definitely have some level of quality, because I'm going to use it for Swift by Sandel, you know, for all of my stuff. So hopefully that's going to be good. But there's always the thing where you might build something that is really good for your specific use case, but then to make it generic enough to enable other people to use it, well, that's a whole other story, right? So that's going to be interesting to see if I'm going to go down that path or not.
Yeah, that's really cool. And yeah, I'm using Jekyll. Jekyll? How do you say it?
I think it's pronounced Jekyll.
Yeah, probably something like that. For my Rambo.codes website. And I have an issue when I use these things, is that there's so much stuff that I don't need. So actually doing the small amount of things I actually need gets complicated.
Right, yeah.
Like, customizing the templates was kind of challenging. It would have been much easier for me to just make an HTML template from scratch, but like changing what's already there, it's kind of complicated. So if you can make your tool be good and better than Jekyll, I will probably end up using it.
I actually don't think it's pronounced that way. I think it's pronounced
Jekyll.
Yeah, like
I would say Jekyll.
Yeah, it's like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, right? That's where it comes from. But yeah, absolutely. I agree, because there's this kind of, you know, two different schools of thoughts when you're building something like this. You can say, let me do kind of convention over configuration. You know, that's the classic, I think, Rails motto, where you are very opinionated in the design of the tool, but that enables people to use it pretty much out of the box, and you don't have to write so much of your own stuff. While my approach to this specific tool is to more not make too many assumptions, but rather just say, here is a domain-specific language that you can use to specify your content, and here's a folder where you can put your templates. And then the tool basically just like iterates through those, to that content, through those templates, and generates the site. So it doesn't have that many things you would need to configure, but you would have to supply more things yourself. Like, you have to build more things from the beginning, which, you know, has pros and cons. The benefits, which I'm trying to really, you know, make use of myself, is I can customize things as much as I want without anything getting in my way. but it might not be as convenient as some of these other static site generators, which is fine.
Great.
So what about you? I hear that you've been doing some hardware hacking recently.
I've been doing a lot of stuff. Yeah, so I've been working on Chibi Studio, as always. Now that I'm part-time indie, I've been able to make some considerable progress with the app, the version 2 of the app. And one of the features we wanted to have, and it kind of came out of a necessity, because we have an iMessage app where you can send like an unfinished chibi to your friend on iMessage, and they can tap the message and like add other items and change colors and stuff like that. And with version 2, we have so many new features, like many new things that you can do with a chibi, that it became impossible to use the mechanism we've been using since version 1, which was to, and this is kind of crazy, our developer friends are gonna love this, actually encode the entire chibi in a URL.
Nice. I love that.
Yeah. It's base 64 encoded gzipped content, and I think it's JSON under the hood.
That's fantastic.
So, yeah, so it used to fit in a URL, but it turns out iMessage has a limit as to how large a URL can be. And now with version 2, we have like the user can add pictures to the chibi, and they can add like drawings and stuff like that. So there's bitmap data, there's transforms that can be done. So there's way too much information to just encode in a URL. So to be able to have this feature back with version 2 for people to be able to collaborate on iMessage, I needed a server component. Fortunately, we already have a server that runs some stuff. And so I had to perform like the exchange of the data through a server. And since I had to do that anyway, I decided, well, might as well add this feature to the main app where the person can just share a link to their chibi that can be opened in a browser, can be sent over any medium that accepts links. And yeah, so I did this, and then I thought, well, since I've made this link, might as well make it a universal link that if you tap it in iOS, it opens the app and shows you a nice user interface where you can import the chibi to your library.
Nice.
And well, since I'm doing this, might as well...
Going further down the rabbit hole. Yeah.
Yeah. Might as well do some NFC tags that
people
can scan. Yeah, why not? Chibi NFC tags.
And soon you're writing your own like NFC networking library and your own QR code parser and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and soon I'm like developing a new RFC standard for chibis.
And then Chibi OS, right? A whole operating system dedicated to chibis.
Yeah, so I was already playing around with NFC for another project, and I decided to try it out, and I had to actually write my own NFC tags. So NFC on iOS, Apple has provided core NFC to developers. I think it's available since iOS 11. But all you can do with core NFC is read NFC tags. And only one format of NFC tag, which is NDEF. So there's limited functionality you can use your iOS device for. Android devices actually allow you to write NFC tags, some of them, with specialized apps. But I don't have an Android device. But I do have Arduinos and Raspberry Pis and things like that. So I purchased an NFC board from a supplier that has like a little NFC chip. And these boards can interface with the Arduino, and you can connect the two of them and actually send it commands to write an NFC tag.
Awesome.
And one of the information types you can have on an NFC tag is an URL to like a website or anything like that. So I wrote an URL to one of these chibi links to an NFC tag and added support to Chibi Studio for background NFC tag scanning. So this is only available on the latest iPhones, the XS Max and the XS and the XR. And what happens is when you approach an NFC tag with your device and it's unlocked, and it reads an URL to which the OS has an app registered for, the universal link mechanism, it will show you a pop-up notification and you can tap the notification and it's going to open the URL just like if you clicked a link. So yeah, that's my NFC story. And actually, I'm currently working on improving my NFC writing device to have like a little Mac app with an user interface that sends commands to the device. And
so you will have a Mac app talking to your Arduino, talking to the NFC like chip or NFC board. So you'll have this like daisy chain of things. And this is all just so that you didn't have to buy an Android phone.
Yeah. Well, actually, at my part-time job, we have Android devices there. And I tried one of the NFC writing apps. It's a Samsung device, one of the most recent ones. And I couldn't make it work for some reason. So I'm not really sure why. But yeah, I couldn't make it work.
Yeah, I guess these things can be really tricky. And I guess also, like, it's a little bit of an excuse, right, to get into hardware hacking. Because hacking on your own hardware stuff can be extremely fun and also very educational as well. Because, you know, when we're writing software, which is usually pretty high level up the stack, I mean, I know you are usually spelunking and you're going deeper and deeper down the stack trace, hence the name of the show, right? most of us, like, who are developers, you know, third-party developers writing apps, we are writing, you know, against pretty high-level frameworks in general. And when you do hardware, it's like the complete opposite, because when I've been doing hardware hacks in the past, I've been working with Arduino and building some fun projects, you know, like thermometers and small little displays displaying things and things like that. It's funny because the code you write is literally the firmware, right? It's like when you turn the device on, it just runs your code. So if you have like an infinite loop in there, the device is like going to get super hot. So I think that's just really interesting from like a learning perspective to learn more about, you know, how firmware works, you know, how to interface with hardware devices. And in your case, also like learning more about NFC, learning how it works under the hood and how to use it for, you know, sharing URLs and things that you're working on.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And with the improvements I wanted to do with my device, I wanted to actually have a way to communicate with this non-existent Mac app, because I haven't actually made it yet. So the best, not the best, but the most easy way to interface with an Arduino with a Mac is through serial. So serial over USB.
Right.
And for those who don't know, it's basically just text. You just send text over USB and it's serial under the hood, but it's through a USB port. And I have this Arduino, is it micro or mini? It's one of those two. It's either micro or mini. The micro versus mini discussion again.
Right, just like USB and everything else and LEDs and everything is micro and mini.
Yeah, and it's basically just a USB connector with a tiny little board with an Atmel chip and some I/O. So I moved my NFC project from the Arduino Uno to this small Arduino so it could be more portable. But then, like, this small Arduino, it's tiny and there's not much space for your program. I'm currently at 92% capacity.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah.
Is that in terms of just like storage, or is that in terms of RAM and memory or CPU, or like what kind of constraints are you hitting?
That's like flash storage.
Right.
In terms of dynamic memories, I'm doing well, I'm doing fine. But yeah, that's like the ROM that actually stores your program. Because I'm dealing with NFC, and I'm not doing the raw NFC stuff. I'm using a library from the manufacturer of the NFC board I'm using. So that occupies a good chunk of space. And I'm also using a JSON library. Yeah, I'm parsing and writing JSON on an Arduino.
Nice.
So that also occupies some space in there. But I'm like, the hardware side of things is almost done. It has all the functionality I want. So I'm sure I'm going to be fine there. But it's very interesting that you have to worry about these low-level details. And like, the program you write is just an infinite loop, basically.
Right,
just
exactly.
It just goes and goes,
yeah.
And I wanted it to like be constantly like polling for serial commands, which are just like a JSON payload that says like, do this command with this data, like write, and I want you to write an URL, and this is the URL, something like that. And I wanted it to also be constantly polling for NFC tags, so it can like send to the Mac the data of the NFC tag without the Mac having to like say, hey, give me an NFC tag, give me an NFC tag. It just like, it's not polling, it's actually like a push. So it's pushing the NFC tag to the Mac.
Nice.
So it can also work as a reader. Yeah, so it's really fun. I recommend, if you are a developer, you've never played around with these things, it's a fun experience.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned this like infinite loop that you have to maintain like your own run loop, which is actually like how pretty much every single app and specifically also games are modeled kind of under the hood. Because now you are very, very kind of low level. You are writing that kind of loop yourself. You're checking on each kind of iteration. You're checking what's my IO status looks like. What does my commands look like? Should I send something? And on iOS, for example, and on the Mac as well, the apps that we write actually work that way too. There's a run loop running under the hood, which you know, manages things like touch events and click events and, you know, all sorts of things, and dispatches that onto our app. So we don't have to write that loop where we're checking, like, you know, we say while true, and then, you know, in each iteration we check something. That's all taken care of by the system. But for me, for example, I've been doing a lot of game development also. And in game development, it's way more common that you are maintaining this kind of loop yourself, where in each kind of iteration of the loop, you're checking like the game control state, for example. Like, is the user pressing this specific key, or has they released this specific key since the last iteration? And this is how you'll make decisions, for example, whether you're going to jump or you're going to move left and right. And this is what I was struggling a little bit, if you remember, on the last episode, where I talked about how I was trying to implement things like this for the iPad, and the iPad doesn't give you those kind of keyboard events. So it's just kind of interesting how different models of programming are kind of, you know, the same, whether or not you're writing like a low-level game, or whether or not you look under the hood of an app, or if you're writing kind of hardware-specific code for something like an Arduino.
Yeah, there's also the language and like framework features situation, because on iOS, which is what we work on the most, you have like this huge amount of APIs that seem like magic. They do everything automatically. And when you're doing Arduino stuff, that's not so true. You have to write right, like this C++ kind of language. And like one example, when my device receives like I want to write a tag command, it has to like enter a different mode. So I had to like implement a modal session kind of thing. So it has to like stop polling for devices nearby reading, and it has to like enter this new mode where it's like waiting for a tag to be present so it can flash the tag. And there has to be like a timeout, otherwise it would be locked up and die.
yeah.
So I added like a watchdog timer as well, just to make sure the device never gets locked up. I think it has like, if it doesn't respond in 8 seconds, it just resets itself, which is, it's kind of like, oh, if my app takes a long time to do something, just reboot the device.
Exactly. Turn it off and on again. Like, that always works, right?
Oh, yeah. And it boots really quickly. It takes like 500 milliseconds.
Nice. Yeah, it's really, really cool that to dive in and to do these things. And I can also assume that you've been learning quite a lot about these things. And, you know, you figured out things like, you know, oh, I have to have a watchdog system. And that's another example of a feature that on iOS, for example, comes built in, right? There's a watchdog that makes sure that the app launches quick enough and doesn't misbehave. But here on the Arduino, you have to build those things kind of yourself.
Yeah, it's not new, super new to me, the Arduino stuff. I've been messing around with it for a long time, but it's like one of the first like real world kind of projects I do with it, and it's been fun. And I have some other stuff I want to do, like I want to experiment with some Homebridge stuff,
yeah.
And like make my own weather station for the apartment. So expect more hardware hacking talk here on Stack Trace.
Awesome. So besides hardware spelunking, there's another thing that you've been busy with lately, and that you've been spelunking again. You know, big surprise, you know, Rambo has been spelunking. And we talked about before how you've been looking into the source code of WebKit, which is open source, in order to try to figure things out. You know, you can see some different signals there in the source code, some different things that are either like not implemented, or they are have some comment that they will be implemented or something like that. And it gives you an indication as to what Apple might be up to. So tell me, Rambo, what's the recent findings from this gold mine that is the WebKit code base?
Yeah, so WebKit, which is the engine behind Safari, so looking at the source code can give you some ideas as to what Safari is going to support in the future. So this time I was looking, and there are specific markers that are put in the code for stuff that's currently implemented or being implemented, but it's not an API that's available in the current shipping versions of the OSs. And that's for like both Mac and iOS. And this time I noticed some interesting stuff related to mouse pointers and download management.
Cool. So download management, are we talking about the little window that you can display on the Mac that shows you like all your current and kind of recent downloads?
Yeah, and it looks like they've been doing some download management stuff for iOS, which is very interesting because currently on iOS, there's really no download manager in Safari. You just get a like normal web page that sits there and loads for a long time if it's a big file. Like,
yeah.
Let's say you're downloading like a 100 megabyte PDF from somewhere. It's just sitting there, loading. And if you like, sometimes if you close, if you go to the home screen and open another app and stuff, and maybe you're RAM constrained, the download just dies and nothing happens.
It's kind of like your Arduino project, right? Where you had to enter a different mode and pause whatever you were doing in order to finish this. It's almost like what Safari is doing right now. It's treating it like a normal HTTP request, right? Like just like loading a website. And then when it finishes, it decides what to do with it.
Yeah, so considering that apparently one of the big changes with iOS 13 is going to be a more computer-like iPad. And that obviously has to do with Safari as well. And I really feel like even if it's only on iPads, it would make a lot of sense to have the full functionality of a download manager. And maybe it could like, when it sees that it's a download request and it's a big file, it can, before starting the download, it will ask you like, do you want to save it to files? Do you want to open it in iBooks after it's downloaded or something like that? And actually have a little downloads manager pop over that you can use to manage your downloads. I really hope that this is it and it's not just like some refactoring or some minor changes, but it looks like they've been working on improving downloads for Safari on iOS.
That's awesome. Yeah, because one thing that I think we've talked about it before, and a lot of people have talked about it as well, is that, you know, we really want to have like the quote unquote real Safari on iPad. And I think when people talk about that, like the real Safari, like what does that mean? Well, I think personally, like what that means is you want the iPad version of Safari to behave as much as possible like it does on the Mac. And what that means is on the Mac, for example, you don't have to jump through so many hoops in order to like download a file from a link. Like you can do some of the stuff you mentioned today. Like if you know that this link that I'm about to tap on is a file and it's linked to the file directly, like not through any redirects or anything, you can just like long tap on that link and say like, you know, open this in files, etc. Right? So there are ways to work around some of these limitations. But the awesome thing would be if, you know, you open up a web page on the iPad and you can just click and interact with it the same way as you would on the Mac. And if you open up a file, it would just, you know, open the download manager, download, ask you what you want to do. You know, you would have the same kind of tab experience and things like that. So I think that's kind of what a lot of people are hoping for with iOS 13 in order to get more productive. Because one thing I've been thinking about a lot recently, and this is maybe a little bit of an aside, but I think it's related, where what is holding the iPad back? And one thing that is holding the iPad back quite a lot, in my opinion, is that all the different services and things you need to do and tasks you need to perform, they all need to be in native apps. While on the Mac, a lot of the things we do are not in native apps, they're on websites. And I think if we can reach the same level on the iPad and to be able to, you know, do the same amount of work in the browser, the iPad could get a huge boost in terms of, you know, its productivity.
Yeah, and another thing I noticed and came to mind now is that there seems to be some stuff around publishing progress for a download. And I remember seeing that term before on the Mac. There's this API, which is, I think it's a foundation API, that's NS Progress. So right, it's just like an object that represents a progress. And at least on the Mac, a progress can be published and it can become available to other processes. So like on the Mac, if you have an app that downloads stuff, you can make the little progress bar appear in the download stack on your dock by publishing a progress that's formatted in a specific way. So I wonder if maybe Safari on iOS 13 on iPad would have like a little progress bar.
Ooh, yeah,
under
that
the icon.
Super cool.
And like if you tap and hold the icon on the dock, you get like a little popover with your downloads, like you get on with the Files app. You get a little recent popover. And
yeah,
that would be really, really good. And I think it matches the theme of iOS 13 on iPad.
Yeah, absolutely. Because just like we talked about on the last episode, bringing more things onto the home screen, like not locking everything into the app itself, like that you always have to launch the app to get some information, I think can be really, really powerful. And if you would be able to like just, you know, long tap on an icon and see your downloads, and you can already see like, okay, my, you know, 2 GB file has completed, you know, 30% of the progress. That could be really great when you're multitasking, you're jumping between different apps and stuff like that, to just be able to see, you know, do I have to go into this app right now or can I wait a little bit?
Yeah, we have iPads with 1 TB of storage now.
Yeah.
It's definitely feasible that someone would want to download like 5 GB. And that's not very easy to do at the moment. So.
Right, no, you have to leave the screen on and unlocked for the whole time just to be safe that it downloads.
Yeah, and I feel like many of these limitations, they it's similar to like, I think we were talking about privately before about cell reuse on iOS. So for those who don't know, when you have like a big scrolling list on iOS, like you can have like 10,000 items. But those 10,000 items, they don't exist on the screen at the same time. That would be very inefficient. So what iOS does is it reuses the cell. So as one of the items goes out the top of the screen, it like goes around and comes back through the bottom and it's changed to another item, which is extremely clever and works very well. But it used to be that, like, on till like iOS 6 with the relatively slow devices we had, you had to do this even if you had only, like, let's say 50 items in a list. But these days, I've been playing around with it, and for some types of user interfaces you want to implement, many of these limitations of iOS, they are not needed anymore, because they came from limitations of what the hardware was capable of, and that's not true anymore. So we can get a way more powerful iOS, and I don't think that would make it necessarily harder to use. It's one of those, like, progressive disclosure situations where if you're a basic user, you just use the basic features and nothing comes in the way. But if you are an advanced user, you use all the features. Like my dad, I gave him an iPad for Christmas, a new iPad, the most recent one that's not the Pro.
Yeah.
And I taught him how to use multitasking, but he never uses it.
Because I'm not surprised.
Yeah, he doesn't need it. But it's not like the fact that multitasking exists is not preventing him from doing the stuff he wants to do just because he's a quote-unquote basic user. It's
right.
Just there, and if you know how to use it and you want to use it, you do. If you don't, you don't. So I really, because many people, they have this fear that, like, oh, but if iOS gets too advanced, then it's going to be harder to use. But that does not have to be the case.
No, it's definitely really a hard and difficult kind of design challenge in order to fit in these more powerful features in a way that doesn't make the more basic usages more complicated. And I think one key here also is when we're talking about, like, you know, maybe you don't always have to reuse cells if the data set is limited, or maybe you can afford yourself some, you know, nicer code in your app in order to, you know, maybe not be 100% as performant or efficient as before, but to end up with, like, much, much simpler code. Maybe that's worth that trade-off. But I think whenever we do these things, both as third-party developers and, you know, for Apple themselves, when they are designing the OS and the different features and what we can and can't do in the background, I think it's super important that we are very selective about it, because one really great thing about iOS is the fact that it is very efficient, it is very fast, and it gives you this, like, really long battery life. You don't have to worry, you don't have this unpredictability. Like, for example, with the Mac, if I run Xcode the whole day and I just, like, run on battery and I just compile and run the simulator, you know, my battery can be dead in just a few hours, while if I do more lightweight tasks like writing, my battery can go on for like 15 hours. So it's way more kind of unpredictable. And on iOS, because of all these power management systems, and because both third-party developers and Apple, they've been very conservative in the terms, you know, they have been implementing things, I think that's also a great strength. So I think we need to be selective on what things we do in the background or what things we, you know, open up. But at the same time, also to your point, these devices have become so powerful that we need to have some way of harvesting that power. And maybe it's worth taking some of those trade-offs to, you know, maybe use a little bit more battery, but to provide a, like, much, much better user experience.
Yeah, definitely. And just to finish up this Safari and WebKit segment, they've been working considerably hard on pointer support for WebKit on iOS.
The dream is alive.
Interesting. Yeah, because, but here's the thing, like, we have Marzipan now, which is iOS running on the Mac, and it needs this translation between mouse input and touch input. It could be that it's just something they're doing to support Marzipan, because it does use the iOS version of WebKit. So let's not get our hopes up too much, but it's possible that we're going to see mouse pointer support on iOS.
Yeah, I think with Marzipan, like you say, I think it makes a lot of sense, especially if they've solved it in a way that they feel is super solid on the Mac, like that you can use the Marzipan app, you can use the mouse, and it all feels super natural. I think, why not bring it to iOS, right? There are many, many different workflows that could benefit from pointer support, like text editing, for example. I did a prototype a while back of using the Apple Pencil for selecting text like you would with a mouse, and it's super nice. You know, it's really, really improves your productivity. So having a Bluetooth mouse that's like connected to your iPad, and you don't, again, to your point earlier, where you don't always have to use it. It's not like you're making the operating system more complicated. You can just pick it up whenever you need it and use it for selecting text or something, and then just use your fingers for the other tasks.
And this would make a lot of sense in the context of Safari, like you mentioned before. One of the things that makes iOS feel slow to me and makes working on iPad feel slow to me is when I have to use a user interface on the web, and it has like hover states for stuff. But like on iOS, then sometimes you touch something and nothing happens, because when you touch it the first time, it activates the hover state. And then you have to like tap it again, and that makes things feel super slow. And if you had a mouse pointer and you could work just like on the Mac with hover states and stuff like that, I think Steve Troughton-Smith actually made a prototype of simulating a mouse pointer on iPad with WebKit, and yeah, it works. It will work really, really well.
Yeah,
there are people who work primarily all day in a web interface.
Yeah, exactly.
And if you could have something like that and it could work well on iOS, I really think like it would be a good option.
Yeah, because what's the dream here? Like, what's the end goal? Like, for me, it is that you can choose whichever device you want. Like, if you want to work on an iPad, you can. If you want that, you know, portability, you want to be able to detach it to a tablet. But it shouldn't mean that you needed to have a, like, harder experience to work on something like the web, right? Because like we said earlier, so much of what we do, especially on a Mac, is in a web browser. And another thing, except for hover state, is also right-clicking, right? Like if you want to select text and copy it and move it around, you have to like first drag it over and hold it. You know, there's so many gestures you need to do. And on the Mac, you just right-click and copy, or right-click and do something with it. And I think those workflows could really benefit from having a mouse.
Yeah, text selection on iOS is a mess.
So WebKit continues to be a really interesting spelunking target for you, Rambo. But another spelunking target is, of course, all the new iOS betas. So have you found something on the latest beta that recently came out?
Yes, I found two significant things. The first of them is that it looks like Apple is going to start using geofencing to limit EKG availability.
Oh, all right. So to assure that it only gets used in markets that it's been approved in.
Yes. By the way, we are breaking these news here on Stacktrace.
The Rambo Report.
Yeah. I haven't published about it because we need to like see if it's actually going to stick and if it's actually going to work like that. But yeah, it's considerably clear from the UI and from the strings I've seen that when you like for you to use EKG on your Apple Watch, you have to do like a little onboarding step on your iPhone, and they added a new step to that onboarding, which is check your location, and it's going to use your GPS on your device to check the location, and it's going to block you from using EKG if you're not currently in the US, which is the only location that's supported.
Yeah, it makes sense, because we were talking on a previous episode that just blocking it based on purchasing location might be enough to kind of, you know, satisfy all the legal aspects. But if you really want to make sure that people only use it when the markets it's been approved in, you know, you need to do something like this.
Yeah, and I have a feeling that this means that they are opening up new markets soon, probably announced during the March event, because the US FDA is probably okay with the way they've done it so far, but maybe they're like negotiating with a new market, let's say the EU, and they are telling them like, oh no, you need to make sure the users are within this GPS coordinate span or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Because if you're talking about the EU, it could also be harder to determine purchasing location, because maybe they're using like, you know, different serial numbers and sharing stock between like especially smaller countries here in Europe. Because, you know, in the US, you have a very, very big, you know, it's very big kind of its own market. But in Europe, it's very, very different, where you have like many, many different small countries that, you know, are in some ways working together as a whole.
Yeah, and a little more technical detail, it looks like it's going to use I said GPS before, but that's not right. It looks like it's going to use your carrier information.
Oh, right. Okay.
To check for that.
Probably more efficient, right?
Yeah, yeah. And also harder to fool the system, because there's like this GPS simulation feature in Xcode, for instance. Right. Uh-huh. And it doesn't apply just to the app you're debugging. It applies to the entire system. So let's say you could use that. I don't know. Maybe there's a private API that says, like, give me the true GPS location.
Right. They could underscore, use, but... underscore location.
Exactly. Yeah. So this is going to be an issue for people like me.
Right.
Who are using EKG outside the US because they have an Apple Watch that's been purchased in the US. And I don't know, but... If they apply this to existing watches, which is not clear from the stuff I found, it's not clear like if you're currently already using EKG, if it's going to kick you out. But if they do that, we can bet there's going to be a class action lawsuit.
Oh, yeah. Poor Apple, you know, whatever they do, there's always someone out to get them.
Yeah, and just another little tidbit from this beta is that it looks like they're going to start upselling you on Apple Care Plus.
Really?
Yeah, there are two new frameworks, new device outreach.framework and new device outreach UI.framework. And what it looks like they do is that they send you like a little notification, hey, you're still under warranty, would you like to get Apple Care Plus for your new iPhone XR or whatever?
You know what that notification could have just said? It could have said, we are trying to grow services revenue, can you please tap this button to make us get more services revenue, please?
Like when you open up Wikipedia and there's this plea for help, like, please donate.
Right, exactly.
Like, please help us increase our services revenue. Wall Street needs it.
Yeah, it seems like definitely one of those things. And it also kind of makes sense, you know, that this is something that they're pushing, because especially in certain markets where you might not have, you know, as strong, you know, consumer laws or warranty laws and things, like having Apple Care extend your warranty and provide, you know, better insurance for you, I guess that could also be, you know, an easy upsell for people who buy already these so expensive devices.
Yeah, and it can also be actually useful for users, because I guess many people who have an iPhone don't even know about it. And
maybe
can tell them, hey, just so you know, you're still under warranty. You have your warranty will expire in, like, let's say 6 months. Would you like to increase it? Would you like to have Apple Care Plus? And it's a more streamlined purchasing flow, like to just do it on device.
Yeah,
with a
absolutely.
Cool little notification. Yeah.
Yeah. It feels like, you know, they could get Siri to tell you this kind of stuff. You know, hey, it looks like your warranty is just expiring. And then Siri is almost going to turn into the new Clippy, right? Where it's like, oh, I can see that you just dropped your device. Maybe you want to purchase some insurance.
Well, let's try it. Is my device still under warranty?
The current volume is 88%.
You're on 88% of your warranty, Rambo. It's time to purchase some Apple Care. Cool. Those were some really interesting findings, and I'm sure that there will be more future Rambo reports on our upcoming episodes as well, as you dig into more of this kind of stuff. But now we want to switch gears a little bit and talk a little bit about AR, and specifically around what Microsoft has just announced with the HoloLens 2. But before we do, let's take a very quick break and thank this episode's sponsor. And it's our good friends at Mac Stadium. Let's say that you need some kind of server, but you don't want it to be a Linux server, because you need to do something that requires macOS. For example, you might want to compile your iOS app, you want to use Core Graphics, maybe you want to deal with plists or some other Apple-specific file format or tool. But more importantly, you don't want that server sitting under someone's desk or inside someone's closet in the office. So if this all sounds interesting to you, then I think you really should head over to macstadium.com/stacktrace to learn more about Mac Stadium. They're the leading provider of enterprise-grade Mac infrastructure with scalable, reliable, and secure private clouds and dedicated macOS servers. Here's how it works. you can just rent a single Mac Mini from MacStadium and use that to perform all the work that you need. You can easily access it from anywhere, and you can use it to serve both APIs or maybe some Swift on the server project. You can serve public websites, or you can use it to move your iOS and Mac development from under your desk and into the cloud. There are so many possibilities with MacStadium, and the best part is that your solution can so easily scale. You can start with just a single Mac Mini, but if you ever need to, you can scale up to thousands of Macs very easily, since MacStadium has over 8,000 Mac Minis racked in their data centers. You can work with experts to create your perfect cloud, and you'll be in good company because MacStadium already has over 3,000 customers worldwide. So if you want to become one of them and help support me and Rambo make the show, then here's what you do. Head over to macstadium.com/stacktrace, just by going to that URL, you help support the show. But if you do decide to sign up, then use the offer code 9to5Mac when you order, and you'll get 2 months for the price of one on a Mac Mini subscription. Now, that's a great deal, right? So once again, learn more about MacStadium. It's a super cool company that we use ourselves since long before they were a sponsor. You just go to macstadium.com/stacktrace and use the offer code for 2 months for the price of one on a Mac Mini subscription, which is 9to5Mac. Thanks so much to MacStadium for their continued support of Stacktrace. All right, so Microsoft has just announced a new version of HoloLens, which is their AR glasses, sort of. It's more like a visor that you can use. And this is the second generation, which has some interesting differences, both in terms of the tech and also a little bit in terms of the marketing and kind of what they're going for here. So first of all, from a technical point of view, I think it's pretty cool because instead of using like a screen in front of you, it uses lasers and it shoots those lasers into mirrors and then shoots them into your eyes, which might sound scary, but I think it's a pretty cool way to render something that is going to literally be projected into your eyes.
Everything is cool with lasers.
Everything is cooler with lasers, right? Sent with lasers. And an interesting aspect of kind of how they're marketing this is that they are completely focused now on businesses and industrial applications rather than for customers. So if you take something like, you know, the Oculus Rift or the PlayStation VR, like these VR headsets, they are very much like focused on consumers, like people like you and me. But for this, Microsoft is saying, you know, let's not focus on, you know, end users, but let's rather build something that people can use in the workspace, which I think is an interesting approach. So, Rambo, I wanted to ask you first, because you've been kind of a pretty much a AR skeptic, you know, up until this point. Do you think that, you know, augmented reality and this kind of, you could say it's mixed reality, right? That you're putting holograms in the reality, so it's like more like mixed reality. But do you think these technologies make more sense in kind of a professional setting?
Yeah, in the current state of things, I definitely believe that for like industrial and professional, even like, let's say, medical applications, it makes a lot more sense to be using AR and all variants in this setting. Because for personal use, other than gaming, I don't really see much use currently for the AR stuff. It's kind of like the foldable phone thing we talked about last week. It's really cool, but there's no like real use for it yet. AR is going to become a real thing for consumers in their day-to-day lives when it's possible to have like a pair of glasses that looks like a normal pair of glasses, but that has AR built in. I think then we're going to be talking. I gave this example before, like I grab my my debit card from my pocket and I look at it and I can see how much balance I have on the card.
Right.
That would be super cool. And people have done this with like iPhones and AR kits. And it's super cool, but it's useless. Because if I have to pick up my iPhone, I might as well just open the app, my bank app, and look at the balance there. So I really feel like it's going to become really useful for regular consumers day to day when you have glasses that are as convenient as regular glasses that have AR built in. But currently, the applications in the industry and in like medical fields and architecture and stuff like that. This is really where it shines at the moment.
Yeah, because you are less concerned in those kind of environments, kind of how the device looks. I mean, I think that the HoloLens, the current version, it looks pretty cool. It looks a little bit futuristic, but it doesn't mean that it's something that I would want to walk around with on the street, right? It's not really like fashionable in that sense, and it's too kind of bulky and big. But in when you're at work, you know, whether that's like some of the things they've been showing off is, you know, someone performing surgery and they can see on top of the patient, they can see like metadata and everything. They don't have to look up or you know, switch context, and that can really make a big difference. Or if you're someone who's doing some repairs on like a big industrial equipment, you can see like the schematics of the machine that you're repairing overlaid on top of it, so you don't have to go and look through manuals and then try to figure out where something is. You can just see it right in front of you. And I think that's a point where, you know, what you're talking about is essentially you want the utility of the device to outweigh kind of the cost of using it, right? Where picking up the phone and launching an app, the cost of doing that is just as high as opening the bank app. So why would you, you know, use the phone to point it to the credit card? It's the kind of benefit doesn't outweigh the cost here. While in this kind of use case, when you are already at work and you're already wearing lots of stuff, you know, for your work anyway, and you're not as concerned about how those things look, but more the utility of them, then you can really start moving more towards a world where the benefits outweigh the cost. And I think that can be pretty cool here where, you know, I think it's a cool way to get into the market, because obviously this technology is going to evolve a lot over the next coming years, but launching it already in this kind of setting and for these applications, I think can be a great way for Microsoft in this case to learn so much more about it and to really accelerate their research and development instead of just being in a lab, it's actually out in the field.
Yeah, definitely. And the thing about the benefits outweighing the costs reminds me of QR codes. Because there's this thing about QR codes that people love putting QR codes. And it used to be that people would put QR codes and stuff just because they look cool. And and you just to visit our website, please download this app to scan the QR code, open up, give it camera permissions, then point the camera at the QR code. Right. I mean, just put the address for the website there.
You're right, exactly.
Yeah, it's much easier. But then there's like things like NFC, like just tap your device into this little sticker and it's going to do something.
Yeah.
It's a small difference, but it does make a real difference.
Yeah, absolutely. And from a kind of a technical perspective, I also think this device is pretty interesting, because what Microsoft has done here is that they've taken a core version of Windows 10 and they've made it run on this device here. So it's a little bit similar to what Apple did with iOS, where they basically took the core of macOS. I mean, the famous Steve Jobs line was, you know, iPhone runs OS 10, right? Which kind of meant in this case that it was using all the underlying technologies from OS 10 and then adding, you know, UIKit and all those things on top of it. What do you think Apple would do in such a case? Like, let's imagine now that Apple is indeed working on some kind of AR glasses or maybe some kind of HoloLens competitor. Do you think they would still use iOS? Do you think they would do the same thing again, where they would take the core parts of the OS and build some kind of AR OS? Or what kind of approach do you think makes sense here?
Yeah, they are working on virtual reality glasses, and the OS that's going to run on it is called ROS, as far as I know. And it is based on iOS, and it makes sense because iOS is mature and it's been adapted to run on so many things. Like, even the AirPower Mat is supposed to be running a stripped-down version of iOS.
Right.
There's even like an AV adapter they have that runs a stripped-down version of iOS.
Yeah, that's my favorite. It's so cool.
Yeah. So it's really, really interesting that they have been able to make iOS run on so many different devices. And there's Bridge OS, which runs on the T2 chips and the T1 chips. So yeah, so it really makes sense for them to make it based on iOS. And it would be like, I don't know, AR board or reality board, or something like that.
Right.
That would run on this new device.
Yeah, because as far as the stack goes, like the actual tech stack on iOS, Apple has shown already that it's kind of possible for them to do both the thing they've done with tvOS, which is essentially to reuse much of the same frameworks and the same APIs, but render them differently. So on tvOS, you can use many of the same kind of classes in code as you would use on iOS, but they just render differently. Like a list looks differently on an iPhone versus on the TV. And on the same note, or like an opposite direction, is something like watchOS or some of these more embedded versions of iOS, where it seems like they are able to strip out parts of iOS and still reuse a lot of the tech stack.
Yeah, yeah. And iOS is flexible, and it's like it's quote-unquote just change the board.
Right.
So yeah, so just remove Spring Board.
Bring your own board.
Yeah, put sound bar, then you have HomePod.
Yeah, exactly.
And yeah, so it's really flexible in that sense, and we could see a new board that's all based on AR kits and it runs AR apps, and it's all based on AR stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think that could be super cool, and it also would enable, you know, Apple to launch a lot of these new platforms much quicker. And this is something we've speculated about a little bit on the past, that ARKit as it stands today might be like a little bit of a Trojan horse, right? Where get it in the hands of developers, get people building all these AR experiences, and then with just maybe a checkbox in Xcode, to steal your line, maybe that's going to just be compilable for AROS and for the AR glasses.
Yeah, these focus of Apple in AR, it's basically like when they introduced size classes. And it was because they were releasing bigger iPhones.
Yeah.
But they didn't say like, oh, please adopt these because we're going to release bigger iPhones later this year. They just say right. Like, oh, it's really important and it's going to make things easier for you. And
we have this resizable simulator, but not because we're releasing bigger phones or anything, just for fun.
Yeah, just make sure your app works when it's in a larger display. Just because.
Yeah.
And with AR, it's kind of the same thing. Like, oh, it's really cool, and we have these really powerful cameras, and you can measure stuff. And so, yeah, so it makes sense for them to be pushing ARKit to developers to have, like, this ecosystem of AR apps. And this could be, like, the main differentiator when Apple eventually comes out with AR glasses, and all other companies already have the AR glasses because they release products based on Apple rumors. And yeah, so they release these glasses, and the big differentiator can be like this huge ecosystem of apps that are already almost ready for this new device and only need like a recompile or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, that's a line that Apple has used before. For example, when they launched the iPad, a big selling point was, you know, all these other tablets, they have no apps, but all the iPhone apps already run on the iPad, you know, natively. So it already has, you know, tens of thousands of apps. And I can see them doing the exact same thing for the AR glasses, where it's like, so in order for these AR glasses to be great, you need apps. But guess what? All the ARKit apps that we've been, you know, seeing from the community for last couple of years, they all run on the AR glasses.
Yeah, and most like AR heavy apps are just a full screen camera view.
Right,
that
exactly.
Does stuff. So that would be not I'm not going to say trivial, but I'm going to say simple enough to adapt to glasses that it would probably just be like minor changes necessary. I don't think you could run them without any changes, because most of these apps still rely on touch input and stuff like that to work. So that's probably not going to be there on the glasses. You're not going to be touching your glasses.
Otherwise, you're going to have to clean them a lot.
So this would be yet another platform, and yet another platform that Apple releases that has many apps from the start, probably.
Right. So another thing I wanted to ask you is the strategy that Microsoft is taking with this, which is that they're going for the businesses first. And, you know, like we've said, be able to get this technology out quicker because of the constraints, because they're shipping a more kind of constrained product. Do you think there's any universe in which Apple would do the same thing, where, You know, they have the iPad, they have the iPad Pro. Do you think that they might be able to come out with AR glasses Pro before they ship the consumer version?
I don't think that sounds like Apple.
No, me neither.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, they usually release the Pro version afterwards. And I'm not even sure there would be a Pro version of this device.
Even though it says Pro on the label or on the product,
it just means better.
Yeah, it just means better, right? Like it doesn't mean that someone can't use a MacBook Air in order to do their work, or vice versa, use a MacBook Pro in order to play games. So yeah, I think that Apple usually don't like these kind of super niche constrained products. They like things to be more general purpose.
Yeah, and even when they do release stuff like, let's say, Final Cut Pro, which is a professional video editor, it's still easy enough to use that regular people can use them without requiring them to be professional film editors or something like that. So
right.
I agree. Yeah, they would probably just release the glasses. And if there is a Pro version, it would probably just have more features and not be like specific to a market. Let's say like Apple releasing a version of their glasses just for doctors.
Right, exactly. The eye doctor.
Isn't that the name of an app?
Yeah, probably. There's always yeah. eye. You can put eye in front of everything and there's an app for that. All right, what do you say? Should we round off this episode by doing some Ask Stacktrace?
Absolutely, let's do it.
Let's do it. So thanks so much, everyone, for sending us more questions. That was really cool to see. Like, we got a bunch of new questions on Twitter. And just to recap how you ask us questions, it's pretty easy. You can just tweet with the hashtag AskStackTrace. You can at mention us if you want, but you don't have to. You can just tweet with that hashtag anywhere, and we'll see it, and we'll try to answer your question on a future episode. Our first question comes from Nopali, and Nopali asks a little bit about Marzipan and whether or not it would be possible for UIKit and AppKit to become more interchangeable within the same app. For example, would it be possible to replace all the NS table view code with UI table view code when you move to Marzipan? And also mentions here, for example, to be able to still use multiple columns. So just to recap a little bit for our non-developer friends who are still listening, thank you so much. table views are basically list views on both the Mac and on iOS, where you just see lists of content, which is, you know, everywhere. But on the Mac, we can use lists in a little bit more different way, where you can have different columns, so you can order those columns and things like that, where on iOS it's mostly just a single column view where you have all the list items. So the question here is basically whether or not Marzipan will enable us to move to UI table view instead of using NS table view, which is the Mac version. So Rambo, what do you think about this?
Yeah, the would this be possible questions are interesting because, yeah, of course it would be possible.
On an infinite timescale.
Yeah, the question really is, would it be done and could it work? And I think, yes, not in the current state of things with Marzipan, because currently you are running an iOS app on your Mac, and that's it. By the way, I've been doing some more Marzipan stuff. Like, I redid the Marzipan version of Chibi Studio. I had done it before, but I've done it now with the latest tools and the latest version of the app that's being developed. Thanks to our friend Steve Troughton-Smith. He made some really good articles last week about this technique of using his Marzipanify tool.
Yeah, we'll put a link in the show notes to that.
Yeah, we can link that. So currently, you are just running an iOS app on the Mac. There are some new APIs you can take advantage of, that, and I suspect there are going to be even more when they announce it officially at WWDC. So you can have control over the menu bar, you can add contextual menus to stuff, you can have a toolbar, you can have tabs in your window, you can have like native Mac-looking alert views. But that's it. And there haven't been many additions to UIKit classes to support the Mac. One of them, though, is a new option for a UI table view style that renders with a translucent background, which is common in macOS sidebars. And this can be seen in the News app on the Mac, and I think the Stocks app also uses it. So yeah, so there have been some changes to some of the APIs. So I could see them adding like API for columns maybe in UI table view. There's also a UI collection view flow layout subclass, which is, I think it's called table view flow layout or something like that.
Uh-huh.
But it's currently private. But I could see them like maybe even, and please iOS developer friends, don't panic. I could see them deprecating UI table view and just moving everything to UI collection view.
Yeah.
And I think it's currently possible if you want to do it to actually do columns and rows in collection views. It's not like super easy, but you can do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But then like this mixing and matching of AppKit and UIKit, it's completely impossible at the moment. What could maybe happen is maybe they have like a, I don't know, iOS NS, iOS Mac view that you can like host a UIKit hierarchy of views inside an AppKit NS view, maybe? Yeah.
And that might sound really crazy, but it's actually not unprecedented because in SceneKit, which is Apple's 3D rendering framework, they are doing exactly that for displaying 2D surfaces within a 3D world, where you can say, here's a SpriteKit, which is their 2D framework, here's a SpriteKit view or a SpriteKit surface that I'm rendering a whole SpriteKit app, like a whole SpriteKit scene, as a texture on this 3D object. So they've already done something like that, so it might sound really crazy, and in a way it actually is, but it might be a way to get around some of these problems where, you know, if you need something that is still part of AppKit and there doesn't seem like any way to do it in a good way in UIKit, that might be like a little escape hatch for you to be able to render just a part of the app using a different UI framework.
Yeah, so it is a possibility. I don't think we're going to get it this year. Definitely not this year.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how necessary that would be. I think maybe just adding more functionality to UIKit classes to be more Mac-like would be enough for people who are working on Marzipan apps.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that would be really cool. And you mentioned like deprecating UI table view and replacing it with collection views. And this is something that a lot of people have been talking about for years because, you know, UI collection view came out in iOS 6. That's a long time ago. And already when it came out, people were saying, you know, oh, UI table view is doomed. But there's still a lot of things that UI table view can do, which collection views can do out of the box. So we're still not there yet. I mean, we could be getting there within the next couple of iOS versions. But I still feel like that's kind of far out.
Yeah, true.
All right, our next question comes from Andre. And Andre wants to talk a little bit more about foldable phones, just like we did on the last episode. And the question is, even if a foldable phone made by Apple might seem like a distant thing, don't you think that iOS would have a much better chance of supporting dynamic app sizes and, you know, dominate the market as it does for tablets with the iPad? So basically, does Apple have a leg up on other manufacturers because it's done all the work with size classes in order to be, you know, to support these fully resizable apps that can run on different screen sizes? So what do you think about this, Rambo?
I don't think they have much of an advantage technically speaking. The layout stuff and resizing of stuff on iOS, it's not that much better than the stuff they have on Android. I've even heard about the Android stuff being better than iOS in that regard. I think the main difference is the market itself. I think the reason that there are not that many Android apps that have special treatment for tablets is not because the API is not good or is not available. It's because there aren't that many Android tablets out there that people are buying and using and purchasing apps for.
Yeah.
So there's basically no demand, not enough demand for it. So I think Apple has an advantage in terms of market because there are already many, many apps that have been adapted to work on iPads and with a tablet size. And another advantage Apple has, which I think is going to be a huge problem with these foldable phones in the beginning, is that Apple has a really good capability of making developers adopt new stuff quickly.
Yeah, and the culture in the community, right? Like,
yeah.
it seems to me that iOS developers in general are more kind of connected to Apple, and that might also be an effect of it just being a single vendor compared to on Android. You know, you can be a Samsung fan, but that doesn't mean that you're necessarily an LG fan or, you know, even a Google fan for that matter. So you might like Android in a single vendor, but on iOS is obviously a little bit different. So I feel like, you know, most people who are developing iOS apps, they have some kind of sense of, you know, craftsmanship when it comes to like building things with the latest tools and migrating quicker to the latest versions and adapting new APIs as well. So that might, you know, also be a reason why it might be more successful.
Yeah, and also because Apple forces you to, like,
right, exactly.
Didn't they like just recently you have to ship with at least the iOS 12 SDK, something like that?
You have to build against that SDK with a recent version of Xcode, but you could still target older versions.
You can target versions from, I don't know, iOS 7 or something like that. But but you have to build with the latest tools, and that's usually what gives you the support for the new devices and stuff. And I can say, like, anecdotally from my own experience, there's not a single app on my XS Max I use that's not adapted to the screen. Like, all of them are. And I use, like, banking apps and stuff like that. And even those are already ready for the XS Max screen.
Even the banks.
Even the banks, yeah.
If the banks can do it, so can you.
Definitely.
All right, awesome questions. So thanks so much, everyone, for sending in Ask Stacktrace questions. And please keep them coming, because we really like to end each episode with answering some questions from the audience. But that's it for this episode, and we'll be back again next week. We're trying now to release episodes a little bit more regularly on Wednesdays. So let us know if that's good for you, if you like that, or how you feel about it. But thanks so much for listening, and we want to again thank our good friends at Mac Stadium for making this episode possible. Head over to macstadium.com/stacktrace to learn more. And that's about it. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.